all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Kyle Carpenter, a Marine who, as a result of his actions in November of 2010, ultimately became the recipient of the Medal of Honor. Kyle, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate you having me, and it's always an honor and a privilege to address veterans and those who support veterans. So thank you again.
Well, Lance Corporal, we want to talk a little bit about your upbringing before we get to your action in Afghanistan, because you're a good old Southern boy. Tell us where you grew up and how you grew up.
So I was born in Mississippi and spent a few years there. But my dad is in business and sales, and as that goes, kind of working up the ladder and into different positions. I spent some time in Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, but my family and I ended up in South Carolina going on 13 years ago now, which we call home, and we have a really great community here and love it. But yes, my roots are kind of everywhere, but I have a soft spot for Mississippi as well.
Well, I want to frame this a little bit, because I think your upbringing for those first 20 years or so before you joined the Marine Corps really is the foundation in which you got yourself through that eventful day, but more importantly, through the surgeries and things that followed. You had the typical, young kid in the South upbringing. You played football. It was a passion, team sports. You had a couple of twin brothers who were sort of looking up to you. You grew up thinking you were Superman when you were a little kid. I mean, give us a little bit of that flavor.
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, you could say typical. And with that said, I very much understand that many people, and many of my fellow veterans and just everyone, does not get, two loving, amazing parents and don't have that tremendous upbringing. So I am very thankful for that. And like you already touched on, I very much believe and know that foundation, gave me the tools that I was able to build on and employ, through later parts of my life. My parents are amazing. They have been there since the moment I was born, and they've been there since the moment that, in a way, I was kind of reborn when I woke up 5 weeks after getting injured. They were there the moment I woke up in the hospital, and they haven't left my side since. But, growing up and just being taught, simple yet profound lessons, take responsibility for your actions. I saw my mom day in and day out, address books and cards and anything you can send to people all over our house. And, whether it was something small or something big, my mom would write thank you notes herself to everyone. If we got anything, any sort of gift, any holidays, myself and my brothers would be sitting down at the kitchen table and writing thank you notes as well, just to say thank you and show people appreciation. And just little things like that I've always carried with me. And from thanking, the janitor at school, to my teachers, to the administration, to, all the people that had a small part in helping me grow and learn and make it through life.
Well, I think it's important that everybody kind of reflect on their own upbringing and see maybe how they're raising their own kids or their nieces or nephews, because it is that foundational development that's going to get you through the other things that come along in life. And we're talking to Kyle Carpenter, who with co-author Don Yeager has written a book that's coming out now, You Are Worth It, Building a Life Worth Fighting For. It's the story of Kyle's life and leading up to and through his being the recipient of the Medal of Honor. This is a William Morrow imprint book, Harper and Collins Publishers. So we want to make sure we point that out. And Kyle, one thing that was kind of typical, you were the kid who got out of high school and said, college or military service? And you elected to go off to the Marines in about, was it 2009?
That is correct. Yes, sir. March of 2009, I went to boot camp at Parris Island.
What prompted you to head towards the military service?
I wanted to do something bigger than myself, and regret and unfilled potential is, I would say, but besides hand grenades now, my only two fears in life. And I just wanted to do something that was bigger than any one individual. And I wanted to do it and not have the fear of waking up one day when I had missed my opportunity and have regret about not joining and not committing myself and now my body and my life to, you know, something greater than myself or any one person or individual.
Well, the book goes through all the training that you and the unit does to get through boot camp and trained up, and ultimately you find yourself in Afghanistan. And since you brought up grenades, we'll move to November 21st of 2010. Tell us about that fateful day.
So roughly a day and a half to 2 days before, on November 19th, myself and the rest of my squad moved to a village and a location south of the small patrol base that we had been living and operating out of for the first 4 months so far of our deployment. Looking ahead, we were over the halfway point. And for anyone not completely familiar for how things work in combat zones or when other units are coming to relieve you, you know, before those next units come in and you go home, what you want to do is expand your presence from how you found it and took it over from the unit that you relieved. So, you know, we went into Marja, we relieved 3-6, another Marine Corps Infantry unit, and nearing that next RIP, we call it, we wanted to push out and expand our presence, and that helps not only continue to push the enemy further out, but also with pushing the enemy further out, making things safer and more comfortable for the locals. Then once, you know, the threats are gone, people start coming out more, you know, they want to take advantage and hopefully one day be able to send their children to school and have, you know, paved roads and running water. So just pushing out that presence more to create more and more stability. And so we had pushed down to a village south of our position, and, you know, within the hour, very soon after we took over that compound, the first grenade attack came. And for the next 24 to 36 hours, we were attacked constantly by AK-47s, small arm fire, snipers, and multiple attacks with hand grenades. And, you know, when all was kind of said and done, and it was time a few days later for my squad, after myself and many of my fellow Marines were injured, to go back to the base where we had initially started out at, we were almost at 50% casualties, and we had barely left our four walls of safety of the base that we were currently occupying. But the day I was injured, November 21st, 2010, myself and a fellow Marine, one of the most amazing and greatest Marines that I have ever had the pleasure of serving with, and someone I'm thankful to call a best friend, Nick Euphrasio, we were on top of a roof together on post. And post is essentially, for those not familiar with military terminology, it's a lookout position. And we were on this roof looking out for any, you know, more hand grenade attacks, any attacks that might injure the Marines who aren't vigilant and on watch and either cleaning their weapons, eating, resting inside the compound. We were at the end of our four-hour shift, which was the afternoon of November 21st. And unfortunately, I don't remember anything in the moments leading up to that daylight grenade attack. The only thing I remember from the entire day before is that morning, rolling out of my sleeping bag around 7:45 or 8 a.m., we were getting attacked. It was a daybreak attack with AK-47s. And it was, you know, that had kind of become our alarm clock over there. So I remember unzipping my sleeping bag and rolling out and kind of thinking, well, you know, here we go, another day in Afghanistan. Fast forward to that afternoon, and really the only thing I remember from the day and the attack is, after the grenade exploded, I remember physically how I felt. At first, I was extremely disoriented, and I was reeling from the blast. I just felt like I got really hit hard in the face, and I was trying to put the pieces together. I was thinking, you know, okay, I was in Afghanistan. The last thing I remember, I was on a roof, but what could have possibly injured me this bad on a roof? Maybe I got off and went on patrol and I stepped on IED, and maybe this is just the last thing I can remember. And those thoughts and me trying to put those pieces together was interrupted by the feeling of what I was thinking in the moment at the time to be warm water. And it just shows you how much Marines love each other and how much we pick on each other, because I was thinking, man, in this banged up, like, terrible shape and state that I'm in, my buddies are still messing with me. But you know, the pieces unfortunately and quickly fell into place and gave me this surreal realization that what I was feeling was not warm water. And it was blood, and I was bleeding out very quickly.
So let me set this, Kyle, because you've acknowledged that, you know, when it happened, you don't have a lot of memory of it, but it's in the book. Yes, it's been pieced together by your comrades and the other Lance Corporal who was up on the roof on post with you. So there was a grenade thrown up on the roof, and instinctually, yes, you covered the grenade to protect your buddy. And your body took the brunt of this grenade explosion, which blew through a lot of you and through the roof. And then there was this amazing effort by your squad and the medics and everybody else to save your life, because, as you say, you're feeling all this quote-unquote water. What it really is you're bleeding out, but they're able to apply tourniquets and save you in the moment and get you on to greater medical care. Do you remember the flights to the various steps along the way to get ultimately to the medical hospital?
No, sir, I do not. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the incredible Navy corpsmen and my fellow Marines that were with me, you know, I still don't know what to say to people that save your life 9 years later now, but I am forever grateful and indebted to them. But no, sir, to answer your question, you know, once I realized that I was bleeding out, I thought about my family very quickly, how devastated they were going to be that I did not make it home. And I said a quick prayer for forgiveness and for anything that I had done wrong in my life. And once I went unconscious in that moment, I did not wake up again for almost 5 weeks. And I did, when I did wake up, it was at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, right outside of Washington, D.C. in Bethesda, Maryland.
And veteran radio listeners, we're talking to Marine Kyle Carpenter, who was a Lance Corporal in Afghanistan. His phrase is, he cuddled a grenade, which I thought was a great turn of phrase.
Which I don't recommend.
Which he does not recommend. And the book, You Are Worth It, which is a great saying, I hope we have time to talk about it a little bit, really walks us through from piecing the story together of the miraculous saving of his life right after this incident where he cuddles the grenade. And you've got to pick it up and read it, because it's going to not only make you feel that, man, this Carpenter guy is, he is Superman, but you're going to see that the medics and the other Marines who jump into action here, it's really inspiring and great to know that these great Americans are out there. But in your instance, you're in a coma, you don't wake up. It's weeks and weeks and weeks before you even get to some sort of semblance of a prognosis of being able to move forward. And I think I read somewhere you had like 24 different surgeries.
That might be around where me and mom lost count, but I think I got up to, 40 or so. Many of those, they would put me to sleep and do multiple life-saving operations and limb-saving surgeries during that time. But overall, it took about 40 surgeries in 3 years to put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
Well, they've done a great job with you, and I want to talk a little bit about the support network that allowed this for you to get through this. The amount of pain, emotional, physical, hallucinations through this recovery process, again, detailed in the book, making it definitely worth reading. But what I don't want to concentrate on that. I want to concentrate on Mom, Dad, and Sadie. Talk to us about those three.
Wow, where to start? To wake up in the physical state that I was in, and to mentally have left off on a hot, dusty rooftop in Afghanistan, and now there is inches of snow building outside of my window pane in a military hospital over 7,000 miles away. I was in bad shape any way you cut it, and I was very disoriented. I wasn't, as a young Lance Corporal, first combat deployment, I wasn't versed or an expert in any way as to military medicine. So to see doctors who I've always seen in white lab coats, wearing camouflage now, it was just so bizarre, and I was so disoriented. And the only thing that wasn't injured on me was my left ankle. And from the second I woke up, the first thing I saw was Christmas stockings. My mom had decorated my room for the holidays. My family was there, my two brothers. And just, from that moment on, just to have, whether it's beside your hospital bed or beside you in life or beside you while you're receiving the Medal of Honor in the White House, at the foundational level, just to have someone beside you that says, hey, I support you and I love you and I'm here for you. No, veteran or not, military or not, injured or not, just as a person and as a human being, to have people and my family, yes, the amazing staff at Walter Reed, just from the moment I woke up, to have the love and support I did, it was, hard for me almost to not stay positive. I woke up and I was alive. You know, incredible, amazing step number one. I just could not believe it, because I truly thought, when I felt myself bleeding out, that that was it. And then I wake up to this bonus round. Yes, I've been fighting for my life. It was so hard and terrible to breathe through a tube for months. And it took me a long, hard road to recovery to get back on my feet. But at the foundation of it all, to just be loved and supported and have a helping hand around my shoulder, you know, was enough to help me be able to continue to knock out the baby steps and, you know, strive to reach that full potential in whatever step of recovery I was in.
Now, Kyle, you've got to talk about Sadie. I gave it a teaser here. You got to bring her back in.
Sadie is our ferocious guard dog, white and fluffy, and about 9.5 pounds. But
now you got to say, no, I want my veteran radio listeners to picture this. Here's this badass Lance Corporal Marine. The guy jumps on a grenade. And one of the things that really helps you get through some down times is this fluffy white dog, Sadie.
Well, thankfully, I know there's a lot of dog lovers out there, so I don't feel like I'm being judged. But, Sadie, she was like any just great dog. She, because after I spent my initial kind of life-saving inpatient 3 months at Walter Reed, you know, at the time, the casualty rate coming in was astronomical. So at one point, there were hospital beds in the hallways at Walter Reed. So when it came time for me to, you know, still need to be taken care of medically, but also I didn't have to stay inpatient every second of every day, I was allowed by the military and the staff at Walter Reed to go home and recover until that following September. And I got done with Walter Reed at the end of January. But I got to go home for about 7 months and recover. And all I could do was lay on the couch. And, I had the tough job of eating mom's amazing homemade Southern cooked food all the time. But, I just laid on the couch, and she likes her personal space and doesn't love to be bothered all the time if she's in nap mode. But, you know, I think she knew, and she sat there with me every second of every day for those 7 months and helped me get better. And, she's the best.
Well, those of us who are dog lovers, and I think that's most of the United States, really understand the therapeutic value of that you get from having your own dog right there with you. But I want to talk about two other things as we continue to move along here. You went through all of those things that we would expect somebody who lost an eye and had their arm, you know, messed up and their legs messed up. You really felt at one point like, hey, I'm damaged goods. Who's going to love me? You were emotionally, your emotions, you felt a lot of hopelessness and doubt. How did you face that and work through that?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, and I'm glad you brought that up, because really, that's out of everything I talk about in the book, this one extremely low moment was not only a defining moment in my recovery, but my life. And it was very shortly after I had left the hospital into February. So this was spring 2011. And, you know, I think up until that point, through all of the pain, the time at Walter Reed, just the surgeries, I think that, you know, I was strong and I was as good as I was, and I pushed as hard as I did, because, you know, aside from all of my physical stuff and my injuries, it was equally as much, if not more, an emotional and mental burden on me, knowing that my family and my parents, who, you know, birthed me and loved me, and, you know, I knew as a parent, I couldn't even imagine, but I knew how just heart-wrenching it had to be for them. So I tried not to show anything but positivity. You know, my dad says he never believed me, but I always would say I wasn't in pain because I didn't want to hurt them anymore. But I was at home in the spring of 11, and it was about 10 o'clock at night. It was almost very movie-like setting. The lights were kind of dim. You know, mom was the only one still up, and I was in the kitchen by myself. And I hadn't had any of my nerve surgeries on my arms. You know, I could barely operate enough or well enough to make a bowl of cereal. I mean, a huge task, one that I couldn't have even done a month before that. So I finally get this bowl of cereal made, and I try to start eating it. You know, I can barely hold the spoon. Even that's a challenge. Up until a couple weeks before this point, my mom was still brushing my teeth, putting on my underwear, tying my shoes. And I'm sitting here trying to eat this bowl of cereal, and the grenade, my doctors, I can't even express how amazing they rebuilt and put my face and my jaw back together. But the grenade blew most of my teeth out on the bottom and some on the top, and really just completely destroyed my entire lower jaw and part of my upper jaw, pretty much everything from my eye sockets down. And so I'm sitting here trying to eat this bowl of cereal with no teeth and, you know, milk. I can't feel my chin because my nerves are severed. And I notice milk is all over my face, dribbling off my chin. And something inside me completely broke. And I started crying harder and harder until I was borderline point of hysterically crying. And mom rushes in, and you know, her first thought is, of course, you know, I'm in pain. What's wrong? And I just looked at her and I just said, you know, who's ever going to love me again? And yes, it was a low moment and it was so hard. And at the time, I regretted saying it because I could see that it absolutely tore her in two. But, and, you know, my book is essentially lessons that over time and reflection and personal growth, you know, I realized a life lesson that I wanted to convey to people. And now looking back, I'm so thankful for that moment, that low, terrible moment at the kitchen counter, because I realized, as upset and down and out as I was, that I could either get up, take one small step and put one foot in front of the other and continue to push through not only my recovery, but the rest of my life and make the best with the cards that I've been dealt. Or the only other option that I had and that we have in life is when you get knocked down, you know, I could have sat at that kitchen counter for the rest of my life. I mean, that was my only, now I realize, you know, that, and I'm thankful I made the choice I did. And I didn't really know exactly what I was doing at the time. All I knew was that, you know, I could have got up and made the best of it and pushed forward, or I would have stayed right there, down and out, crying, you know.
Yeah, you know, I think,
and eating, that's trying to eat that bowl of cereal for the rest of my life. And so, really, the turning point in my recovery, and really where I've decided that I was always going to move forward and never look back, and what happened, is right there, sitting at that kitchen counter.
And it's really those sorts of life lessons that we try to bring here on Veterans Radio to our listeners who might be having their own struggles. And we're talking to Kyle Carpenter, who's a Medal of Honor recipient, a Marine, Lance Corporal, who cuddled a grenade and lived to tell about it, which is amazing. That's why he refers to his life now as part of the bonus round. And his book, You Are Worth It, Building a Life Worth Fighting For, is so extraordinary. Kyle, I want to talk to you about some of the other life lessons you've learned that maybe you can pass along. You're 30 years old, but you've lived through a lot, at this point. You say don't hide the scars. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
So don't hide your scars, chapter in the book. You know, at one point in my recovery, I tried scar revision therapy. And, you know, the doctors, after I got out of surgery, they kind of said, hey, you know, we have this laser treatment. We can smooth a lot of these scars out on your face. And, you know, I was there for 3 years. It was there available. So I just kind of said, you know, why not? I'll try it. And I came out of that and my face was swollen. I mean, it literally looked like I had just stuck my head in a beehive. And so I got back to my room and I was looking at myself in the mirror and I kind of had a, like, what am I doing type moment. And I asked myself that for two reasons. One, trying to smooth out the scars on my face, would that be possible? Yeah, with a certain number of treatments, probably might make me look a little prettier. It'd be hard, but it might make me look a little prettier. But, you know, then you go, you know, down and you get to a massive scar on my neck. That goes from my ear all the way to the other side of my neck, my trach scar. And then we don't have enough time the rest of the day to talk about the scars from neck down. But, you know, it's kind of how I refer to it in the book. It would be, you know, smoothing the scars out on my face. It would be trying to buffer out a dent in a car that's been totaled. And so, you know, kind of evolving from that thought process. You know, I speak when I go and publicly or motivationally speak to people, you know, and I wrote this book and I tell people to own their scars. You know, who am I if I'm sitting here trying to get scar revision therapy and trying to get rid of the things that I'm telling people to be proud of and to own? And through that thought process, you know, I kind of solidified in my thought process that scars are, you know, really beautiful. And, you know, people might see them as physically different or physically, you know, ugly, but scars show, you know, are a physical representation that you have not only lived, but you've been knocked down or you've been, you know, injured or you've bled or you've had these hard times. And scars can be absolutely just as much mental and emotional as physical. Now, those are much tougher, obviously, because people can't see those a lot of the times and people might not want to talk about them. But as far as my physical scars and people's physical scars, you know, be proud of those. They show that you've lived a life and you've pushed through whatever gave you those scars. And now, yeah, you might have a scar, but you have knowledge and experience and more resilience and perseverance when the next challenge or, you know, the next life obstacle comes your way. And above that, you know, not only for yourself, but you can connect with other people who have struggled. And, you know, struggle was kind of my light bulb term and moment, you know, when I realized I could write this book and focus it on struggle, because I didn't want to write another book about just strictly a military or combat focus. I wanted something that transcended all boundaries and that, you know, anyone could pick up and not only understand and process, but also take lessons from. And when I realized that the angle I could take is struggle, because everyone and every person on this planet, you know, that's that common thread through us all, physical, mental, physical, or emotional.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, scars, you know, own them. And be thankful for them, because you're still living and you're still breathing and you're better and stronger, you know, than you were before.
That's what I think one of the real values of this book is, You Are Worth It by Kyle Carpenter. And I said to Kyle early on, before we got on air, that I read this book and immediately wanted to talk to him, but they said, no, the book's not coming out yet until October of 2019. You can't talk to him yet. And it's because it transcends. This isn't just a typical military war story book or even a recovery from a brutal medical condition. It's really got a lot of life lessons in it that apply to anybody in their circumstances if they read it and have an open mind in that regard. So I think you've accomplished your mission, Kyle, in writing about the struggle and making it available to others who may have different types of struggles. But we all have struggles and we all have scars. Some are more prominent, some of them are earned while saving somebody else's life, but we've all got to work through our struggles, don't we?
Absolutely, absolutely. And just like that moment at the kitchen counter, you know, it's okay to not have a plan or not know what the next step is or where you're going, you know, but you need to realize, and if you need to take time to heal, whether it's a month or a year, that's okay. And that's completely fine. And you're on your own time for your own healing purposes. But one day, you know, as tough as a pill as it is to swallow, you're going to have to realize your only two options are to stay exactly where you are or take that one small baby step and put one foot in front of the other. And, you know, I think my favorite line from the book is, you know, even the smallest of steps eventually completes the grandest of journeys. And that's something that, you know, was a hard lesson I had to learn over many years and many dark nights in the hospital, you know, but it is true. So you don't have to have a plan. You just have to just make that step.
Let me turn now, if we can, as we come to the close, and talk a little bit about the absolutely unique honor of being a Medal of Honor recipient. No one ever seeks to be a Medal of Honor recipient. Nobody ever expects to be such. And I don't think most people can understand the level of scrutiny that goes into receiving this highest honor that the military awards, the president awards. Tell us a little bit about the lead up to it, the ceremony, and then I've got some questions for you after that.
So early on when I was still during my three initial months of inpatient care, a fellow Marine had called me and kind of unofficially given me a heads up, you know, hey, we all saw what you did. The evidence is there. You know, essentially we believe, at least just my platoon and my fellow Marines on the ground, that, you know, they believe that I deserved it. Well, you know, that's obviously just, even in a healthy, not injured state, that is a very difficult and big idea to even comprehend. So probably my brain as a defense mechanism, I kind of forgot about it. I told him, thank you. I appreciate it. I was very honored that my fellow Marines and buddies thought that much of me. But, you know, we hung up and that was really it. And I focused on my recovery and I pushed forward. I didn't think another thing about it. And with anyone familiar with military awards process, you know, not in a negative way and not bashing anyone, but I just didn't think there was any possible chance that in a million years this could happen. So went on to recover. Well, I was years into my recovery, still at Walter Reed, and a Marine called me and told me essentially that they were officially gearing up and moving forward with a potential Medal of Honor investigation, and they wanted to talk to me about what I remembered and my actions that day on the roof. I apologized and told them, unfortunately, I couldn't contribute because I did not remember, and they thanked me for you know, just being a Marine and who I was. And they told me that no matter how it panned out, that 2-9, my unit was proud of me. And that was enough for me. So we hung up the phone, and 2 years later, I had done my 3 years at Walter Reed. I had since left the hospital, and I was in the middle of my sophomore year at the University of South Carolina. And the Pentagon and Marines from the Pentagon started casually calling me and checking up on me and seeing how I was doing and kind of where I was at in life. The calls got more frequent until we got to a point early in 2014, maybe very late 2013, you know, talks really started to become official. And then after 6 months of, you know, kind of preparation and PR training and all of these things, I finally got word that of the day and the exact minute that President Obama would call me. So I left class and I drove the 30 minutes home to my house outside of Lexington, South Carolina. And we had checked my two brothers out from school because they were still in high school at the time. I wanted them to be there for that special moment. And so my family, we were all sitting in the living room. My mom had already yelled at me because I walked into the house with, I think, 7% on my cell phone battery. She's like, the president of the United States is about to call you and your phone's on 7%. But hey, you know, I'm a college student. So,
this is so mom, right?
Yeah, so mom. And she yelled at me and got on to me for having yucky shoes on. But it was over the phone, so, you know, I wasn't too worried about it. But yeah, definitely mom moves. But I got plugged in. I was charging. We were all good. And the call came through, and it was very, very surreal to talking to the President of the United States on the phone and him asking me about life and how things were going. And then he proceeded to tell me that based upon the recommendation from the Secretary of the Navy and the Secretary of Defense, he has approved for me to be awarded the Medal of Honor. He said he would see me in D.C., and I wrapped up the call and went back to class.
It is an amazing experience, I'm sure, and I've talked to a number of Medal of Honor recipients who've received that call, some of them decades and decades, you know, as many as 50 years later that they've received this call. So for you to receive it as young as you were is kind of a surreal moment. But as we wrap up, maybe my final question to you, because I think we could talk all afternoon. But let me ask you the final question here, which I've asked other Medal of Honor recipients. Talk to us about the responsibility you feel as a Medal of Honor recipient.
Well, probably, you know, the best note to end on. So I appreciate you leaving a little time for this. It is a beautiful burden. And, you know, first and foremost, I'll say that I'm so honored and humbled and appreciative that my country, my government, you know, our military and Marine Corps recognize me and my story, you know, therefore recognizing my unit, my fellow Marines, and what we went through as a band of brothers. You know, but to go deeper, and I'm so glad I can relay this because, you know, with the Medal of Honor, everyone sees the pictures and the interviews and David Letterman and ESPN. And, you know, I got to go to the Super Bowl as a recipient and all of these amazing things. And it is incredible. And, you know, I'm a fun, loving life, tackling it full speed ahead, love football, sports. Like, of course, I am so enjoying these amazing opportunities. But to really think about the medal, you know, the medal represents my story, my injury, and my recovery, yes. But then it also represents those long, hard nights in the darkness of my hospital room that my parents sat through and my brother sat through. You know, then it represents my fellow Marines that were there on the ground with me, that got my blood on their hands, keeping me alive and doing everything in their power to get me back home to my family. You know, and then it represents the Marines that were with us that at 19, 20 years old gave their last full measure of devotion for us and for our country, that some people may never hear their story. And then you go beyond that, and it represents, you know, all of the service members and women from, you know, our War on Terror generation. But to go further, you know, it represents previous generations, you know, those that you know, died in a random field that most Americans will not only never know where it is, but can't pronounce, in lush fields throughout Vietnam. You know, those Marines that froze to death, you know, and died fighting for the liberties of people, you know, throughout Korea, and the Marines and the troops that charged the beaches during World War II, and they were told, you know, if you're lucky, you're going to make it to the beachhead. And even if you make it to the beachhead, you're going to have probably 20 seconds to live, and still did it, knowing that there was a bigger and greater cause than themselves or any one individual, and that the Marines that were charging those beaches to the right and left of them, you know, their lives were just as important, if not more important, than their own, and all of the campaigns before that. So it not only represents all the generations, but then you think about, you know, not only are there those that gave their life, but there are those that 30, 40, 50, 60 years later, they're still missing in action. We still can't tell their families and their loved ones how they gave their last breath on earth for their country. So to know, yes, it's amazing, and I'm so honored, but at the same time, to know the weight and the history it represents is still 2014, you know, 6 years later now, still almost too heavy and powerful to comprehend. And, you know, outside the walls, outside the borders of our country, you know, the Medal of Honor in our military represents, you know, and is a beacon of hope for so many around the world. I mean, there's always big political reasons about going to war and doing this and doing that. But, you know, people need to realize there are tens of millions of people around the world every single day. You know, when you get up and you hit the button on your Keurig, there's people that wake up every day of every, you know, year of their life, for their entire life. They wake up and they just think, oh, wow, you know, I hope one day, I hope I can have the freedom to make my own choices. Or one day, you know, I hope I can get a big, you know, cold, you know, glass of ice water and fresh water that I don't have to walk a mile down a hot, rocky, dusty road with no shoes on my feet just to draw dirty water out of a well to bring back to my mud hut home. You know, it's just to, you know, I hope one day that I can know what school is and I can maybe go to a classroom and be taught something. You know, just very simple things. But, you know, with all of that said, I'm honored as a representative of the Medal of Honor and as a recipient, but, you know, I'm just as honored to have had the privilege to serve in our military and to whatever capacity I did or we did, you know, help the people of Afghanistan who, you know, struggle under the Taliban every single day. And, you know, like I said, who one day hope to just have fresh, clean drinking water, be sure. able to go to school and not worry about, you know, being blown up or killed. So, sorry, I went a little off on a tangent, but, you know, I've seen it.
You've lived it.
I'm passionate about it, and I'm thankful to be a Marine, and I'm thankful to be an American.
Kyle Carpenter, Medal of Honor recipient, Lance Corporal, United States Marine Corps, author of You Are Worth It, Building a Life Worth Fighting For. And we didn't get to talk about the title, which I think is a great title. It's a William and Morrow imprint of HarperCollins Publishing. Kyle, thank you for spending some time with Veterans Radio today.
Absolutely, sir. Thank you for this opportunity. And to all the veterans out there, you know, thanks for raising your right hand when not many others would. It's an honor.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.